Welcome to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me now is President Thomas Jefferson. Good day to you, sir.
Good day to you, citizen.
Mr. Jefferson, I know it's good manners to begin a conversation with pleasantries. However, the subject for this week's conversation, I believe, is a pleasantry for you. I'd like to talk about wine, if we might, sir.
It's one of my favorite subjects. It's certainly my favorite beverage. I spent a good deal of time in the course of my life trying to import good wines. I brought vine stocks back with me from France when I returned from my 5 years there in 1789. I was, I suppose you would say, the patron of wine growing in the New World, somewhat pessimistic about its prospects. And I served the best wines that were ever served during my lifetime at the White House.
And you were famous for, I don't know if lecturing is the proper word, but giving lengthy descriptions about the wine that was drunk. In fact, I believe it was Mr. Adams who left a letter behind.
John Quincy Adams.
Talking about a description of wine at a dinner.
Well, you know, he was a sourpuss, John Quincy Adams. He never particularly liked me. His father loved me and forgave me for the political squabbling that occurred during the 1790s. But John Quincy Adams, on behalf of his father, never really forgave me. And he regarded me as a kind of a fatuous optimist and a man who's prone to philosophical reverie and not sufficiently grounded in the Calvinist nature of man as a sinner and as a broken, selfish, lustful, rapacious creature. And so the father was one of my dearest friends, and we ended our lives on a beautiful note of harmony and deep, renewed friendship. But his son could never quite stomach me. He did become a political ally during my 2 terms as president, particularly during my 2nd term, and he frequently voted with my party, the Republican Party, although he was nominally a Federalist. And he, I think, admired me up to a point, but he just really didn't like me. But I invited him to dinner at the White House frequently. I invited 10 or 12 people 3 or 4 days a week, and John Quincy Adams was a guest often. And because Washington was a brand new town carved out of the howling wilderness on the Potomac, there weren't very many amenities there. There weren't good hotels, there weren't good bookshops, there wasn't good theater, there weren't restaurants, there weren't tobacco shops, and so on. They did begin to emerge in the course of my presidency, but almost everybody hated Washington, almost without a single exception, during the years when it had just emerged as our national capital, and particularly because of the contrast between Washington, the new capital, and Philadelphia. And, you know, Philadelphia was at the time the 2nd largest city in the British Empire, and it was the cultural capital of the New World, and it was a splendid place with great bookshops and great restaurants and wine bars and so on. So suddenly, instead of being in the cultural capital of the United States with about 60,000 people, Congress and all the cabinet secretaries and so on were in this little frontier village where the streets were muddy and hogs were still rooting around on Pennsylvania Avenue, and the trees hadn't been cut down, and the White House wasn't finished, and the Capitol wasn't finished, and there was no culture, and the basic hospitality was pathetic, abysmal. I loved it, of course, because it looked out on the prospects of the Potomac, and I liked the symbolism of a new nation with new principles and having a new capital carved out of the wilderness itself. That deeply appealed to me, but not really to others. So people hated it, and I tried to ease their suffering as congressmen in Washington or cabinet secretaries by providing hospitality at the White House. And I had learned a good deal about this, not only at Monticello growing up, but my 5-year residency in France had taught me how exquisite food and wine and good bread and the way food is served, the pacing of it, and how one dish complements another, and, you know, the sort of an artistic integrity to good food service and the selection of the meal. I had learned all that in France, and I brought it back with me to this country along with a French chef who was my maitre d' at the White House. And so people would come who might despise me politically or loathe me for my role in the Revolution, or think that I had been a coward by not serving in the armies of the Revolution, or whatever it was. People who disagreed with me politically for good reason or bad, or who disliked me personally for good reason or bad. Nevertheless, they always accepted invitations to come to my White House because they knew that the food would be exquisite, the manners would be impeccable, and the wines would be extraordinary. And it was not uncommon for me to serve 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 different types of wine at one of my afternoon meals. And so John Quincy Adams would come, and he was a cosmopolitan. He had lived in Russia. He had seen the world and knew a great deal about it. In some respects, he was more cosmopolitan than I was. I always regarded myself as a kind of a savage from the woods of Virginia, and he regarded himself as, you know, as a Bostonian, as a man from the great civilized state of Massachusetts, not the cavalier countryside of Virginia. And he would come, and it's clear that he loved the wines. And depended upon my hospitality. But he sneered, too. And in the letter you speak of, he went away and said, oh, Mr. Jefferson had large discourses on his wines.
Not very edifying, but I assume he partook of the wine.
Oh, absolutely. In other cases, William Plummer. William Plummer of New Hampshire was a senator who was a Federalist and despised me. In fact, he was involved with the New England junta that actually tried a secessionist movement during my administration. And when he first came to Washington, he regarded me as the Robespierre of the New World and spoke of me as a vulgar Democrat and a political visionary and a Frenchified radical and a man of unreliable politics. And he came to dinner, and his diary has a famous diary, Senator Plummer, and at first he would come grudgingly and make nasty comments about his time at the White House. And then over the course of the 5 years that we were both in Washington City, his criticisms became less raw and less mean-spirited and ad hominem. And eventually, in my second term, he began to enjoy his time with me and to count on it. And it wasn't just the wines and the food any longer. He actually grew to like me and possibly even admire me. And he would then discourse with great eloquence and joy about the wines, the Tokay or the Bordeaux that I had served, or the fine champagne. And as I finally left Washington voluntarily after 2 terms, he came to me and asked me to stay on for a 3rd term. I don't suppose it had much to do with my politics, but it had a great deal to do with my wine.
Well, the reason I bring this subject up, Mr. President, is we've gotten a couple of emails wanting to know about some wine bottles. There was an article in the New Yorker magazine. Evidently, they think they've found some of your old stock. But before we get to that, I wanted to talk about your budget for wine. It's my understanding in your first term, you spent a sum of $7,500 on wine, quite a sum.
It's true, but a couple of things that you should keep in mind. One is that the president's salary was gigantic. It was $25,000 per annum at a time when a middle-class person might earn $500 per year. So it was a huge figure. But the president was expected to pay all of his own expenses out of that fee. So it was salary plus living expenses. And this was the only time in my life that I had a significant cash flow. You know, for 8 years, I had $25,000 per year, and it allowed me to finish Monticello. It allowed me to begin Poplar Forest, my second retirement home, my octagonal experimental house in Bedford. It allowed me to pay off some very pressing debts, but I also used it to provide the kind of hospitality that a president inevitably must provide. And as I've already said, because Washington was a raw frontier villa, it was really important that the president provide hospitality of an unusually good sort, because there really was nowhere else for people to turn. And so I did spend a large amount of money on wine. Obviously, I drank very little of it myself. So far as I know, I was never intoxicated in the whole course of my life. I'm a very temperate man, not an abstemious man. I drank wine every day, but I'm a very moderate and temperate drinker. But when people came to the White House, 10, 12 people, 3 or 4 times a week, I, of course, served them wine, and I served wines at my annual receptions. There were 2 of them per annum, one on January 1st, New Year's Day, and another one on the 4th of July. And so champagne and and red wines and white wines and dessert wines and so on were all an important part of presidential hospitality. I think in my first year as president, I spent $2,400 or so on wine, and in my first term, about $7,500. But keep in mind, I wasn't just serving that wine. I was building a wine cellar at the White House. And so there was, as time went on, in my second term, I was able to ease up a little on the expenditures because I had now built a cellar, and there was a rather large stock of wine that I could draw upon on these occasions.
Forgive me, but I must ask you, Mr. President, what was the state of that wine stock when you left office?
Well, there was a little left because, of course, I wanted Mr. Madison to begin his presidency on the right note. And I will say this, and it will sound self-aggrandizing, and I certainly don't mean it to be, but of the first five presidents, George Washington, John Adams, myself, James Madison, and James Monroe, I knew almost infinitely more about wine than any of them. Monroe knew a fair amount because he had spent some time in France. Madison never went abroad at all. John Adams was the most John Bull Yankee kind of American. He was Adams did not have exquisite taste. He was a Madeira man and a port man, and Adams' tastes are pretty basic. George Washington had pretensions to aesthetic taste, but he was unsure of himself. You know, he had not traveled in Europe. And Washington, while he was president, turned to me. I was just back from France and asked me effectively to be his wine advisor, almost his wine steward. And there's a rich correspondence between us in which I gave him advice about what wines to serve and what wines to order and how to go about it. That's something I knew a great deal about. So I was the wine advisor to Washington, certainly, to Adams, to a certain extent, and of course to Madison and Monroe. And I think it's fair to say, I hope this doesn't seem too egotistical, but I would doubt that there was any eight-year period in the history of the White House when better wines were served than during my two terms.
Well, Mr. Jefferson, we need to take a pause in a few moments, but when we return, I'd like to talk to you about these mysterious bottles with the initials THJ on them, if we might, sir.
I'll explain how I bought wine and why bottles might have that etching.
I look forward to hearing that from you, sir. We'll return in just a moment. You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. And seated across from me now is Mr. Jefferson. Welcome back, sir.
Thank you.
We're having a splendid discussion about wine. I so enjoy hearing you talk about this. I had a couple questions about your White House wine cellar. It must have taken a tremendous amount of planning, these dinners, these wines that you served. Were you, sir, responsible for that, or did you have assistance?
Well, I had a French chef. And I had a secretary, Meriwether Lewis was the first of them, but there were a number of them during the course of my presidency. And I had black slaves that I brought with me. My personal staff at the White House was not a government staff. I brought my own household slaves, my serving slaves with me from Monticello. And they all, of course, had lived with me for a very long time and knew how I liked to do things and knew that wine was a central part of my view of Virginia hospitality. So I was fortunate in that regard. But I was hands-on, I think is the term you use, to a dramatic degree. I not only plan menus, but I carefully chose the guests and chose where I wanted to position them, where I wanted to sit them so that they would not irritate each other, and the people who had common interests would be next to each other. And I planned the wines and would make elaborate lists of how the wines would be served in what quantity and at what pace and tied to what portion of the dinner. And so I was very active in this. I also, with my almost unbelievable rage for order and detail, created a chart of the greengrocers in the greater District of Columbia, Georgetown and Alexandria and so on, and my favorite vegetables, whether they were artichokes or radishes or tomatoes or onions. And this chart was enabled me to know where the vegetables that I most wanted were best purchased at what greengrocers, at what seasons. It was a sort of a guide so that if I were planning a meal and I needed asparagus and it were June, I would know which greengrocer that was most reliable in that respect. And I sometimes did the grocery shopping, if you can call it that, for the White House myself. I wouldn't carry things back in bags, but I would go to these greengrocers and I would say, you know, we're having a meal next week and I want it to be such and such, and could you supply these potatoes or could you supply these artichokes? And so I was very actively involved in all of this, and particularly the wines. I not only ordered the wines, I engaged in an extensive correspondence with vignerons and negociants and others to get the wines that I wanted. And I then would taste the wines to determine if they were good. It was an exhaustive thing, but I never felt that it was a burden. This is something that I very much enjoy doing. And it was, genius is attention to detail. And I was a great lover of detail, particularly if it would make a grumpy senator from New Hampshire feel more cheerful, or if it would make someone who was in Washington City and his wife and children were back at Baltimore or all the way down in South Carolina, if it made his loneliness a little less pronounced, if it gave him some sense that the sacrifices he were making for his country by leaving his work and his family and coming off to the national capital, if it made that a little less burdensome for him, a little more delightful, then I felt that I was being a good host.
Yeah, I'm certain it had the same effect on you, sir.
Well, the host seldom enjoys things quite as much as the guests, and I had been drinking good wine all of my life, and I had I suppose you would say, a more discriminating taste than many of the raw congressmen from Kentucky or Ohio or New Hampshire. But the fact is that I love wine. I said, I cannot live without wine. I said, I regard wine as a health food, essentially. Certainly I regard it as a work of art, and I can't imagine a good meal that would not include good wine. And, you know, anybody can serve Van Ordinaire, the house wine, good enough wine. The world is filled with good enough wine. But the President of the United States can't serve good enough wine. No Van Ordinaire at the White House. The President has to serve exquisite wine.
Well, that brings up another point, sir. It wasn't as if you could walk down the street and pick bottles off a shelf. You had to devise a method to get these fine wines from Europe, did you not?
Good point. I played a fairly important role in the development of the transatlantic wine trade. Here's the problem. True wine is very delicate. It doesn't travel well. It doesn't like jostling. It doesn't like radical temperature changes. It needs to be held in a certain position, and it needs to be protected from extremes of temperature and the buffeting that can occur in the hold of a ship. And so there really wasn't a transatlantic wine trade. And when I arrived in France, I discovered there was a firm led by Pierre Gestier and a man named Barton, and they had pioneered the shipping of wine from France to Ireland and England. And that firm, founded in 1725, is still in your day known as B&G or Barton and Gestier. And their genius was to find a way to get wine from across the English Channel. But it wasn't easy. And as you know, England doesn't produce good wine. So when I went to France, I tasted these exquisite Burgundies, Montrachet, Chambertin, Montepulciano in Italy, the Bordeaux, Chateau Yquem. You know, I tasted just almost an infinite variety of the finest wines in the world. I toured the wine districts of France in 1787 and took elaborate notes. My journal, you know, it's not a Boswellian journal about the state of my soul or my romantic urges or my views of life and death. I'm not interested in any of that, and nobody else would be either. I was interested in how far apart you plant vines and how you trellis them and how you prune them and what season you harvest them at and what soils produce what sorts of wines and under what climatic conditions. And so I made this extensive journal of my wine travels, and everywhere I went, I would meet the vigneron, or I would meet the négociant, or the owner of the vineyard, and I would say, how can I get wine from your vineyard to the shipping docks at Bordeaux or Marseille? How can they be properly cared for there and then placed on a ship under certain conditions, properly insulated from temperature swings, properly insulated from the bustling and the rough treatment that things have in the holds of a ship, offloaded as soon as it gets to dock? How can we avoid breakage? And I actually developed a very severe regimen that I placed in my wine contracts and said, I will not take shipment of these wines unless they are packed in such a way, unless they are shipped between X date and Y date. I knew that it would be no good to just give money to a wine merchant in France and hope for the best, because the breakage was enormous. And even if the bottles came intact, the delicate wines were often destroyed by the transport. And frankly, as a historical note, that's why in the British Empire, there were no wines. There were fortified wines. Brandy is a fortified wine. Port, fortified. Sherry, fortified. Madeira, these what I call the alcoholic wines, were supplemented. The wines were supplemented with spirits, because that made them less delicate and allowed them to travel more safely. And so the British Empire depended upon sherry and port and brandy, because they could be transported across the oceans of the world more or less intact, whereas an actual bottle of real wine, a Burgundy, almost impossible to do. And my role was two things, was to work with these wine merchants and the vineyard owners and the vignerons to create a set of protocols for the actual shipment of these under the best conditions possible, given the technologies of our time. And the second big issue, which we can talk about if you wish, is how, in an age before international credit systems, how does somebody living in Charlottesville buy wine from 17 or 20 different winemakers in France? In your day, it's a simple electronic transaction. In my day, it was an almost infinitely complex set of transactions that frequently broke down, and the lines of communication were so slow that I could write a letter to someone in Bordeaux in 1803 asking for 50 cases of something, and that letter might never get to him. If it did get to him, it might be a year or 6 months later. Then he would have to go through all this crazy labyrinthine work with credit, with tobacco merchants in London and wine merchants in Marseille or Bordeaux. And eventually he might ship the wine. And if he shipped a case of it, half the bottles might have broken in transit. And so it was just a nightmare. But it's not so much a nightmare that I didn't want to do it. I still wanted to make it happen.
Well, Mr. President, I believe I'll pass on the financial aspect of that and stay on topic of wine, if that's all right with you, sir.
That's fine. But simply to say that in your day, you live in a perfect global community with respect to transference of funds.
Yes, sir.
And if you lived one day in 1803 and had to do what we did in order to get monies transferred for this sort of thing, you would buy much less.
I know, Mr. Jefferson, that you spent a great deal of time trying to grow grapes at Monticello, which leads me to the subject of a Mr. Thomas Mazzi.
Yes, Philip Mazzi was a florid Italian patriot and freedom fighter who came to the New World, and he wanted to do a whole range of things in America, and particularly in Virginia. And he was traveling the country with another man who was an American wine aficionado, and they came up to Monticello, and I served them a meal or two and the best wines that I had at the time. And Mazzi fell in love with the Blue Ridge Mountains and the Piedmont where I lived, and he decided on the spur of the moment in his impulsive Italian way to create a vineyard right there. And I worked with neighbors to make sure that there were lands that he could rent and purchase, and he then intended to create a Virginia wine industry and dutifully tried. Things never really worked out for Philip Mazzi. He soon went back to Italy. A number of German officers who were prisoners of war were stationed near Monticello during the Revolution, and they rented or occupied the property that Mazzi had worked on, and their German horses actually trampled many of the vines and destroyed them. And so Mazzi had no success as a winemaker in America, but as a kind of wine ambassador or an advocate of the growing of wine, he did. And as you say, I brought back cuttings, vine stock, root stock, of the best French grapes when I returned to this country in 1789, and I dutifully planted some of them at Monticello and distributed others to friends who were interested in the same. But I never pressed grapes for wine at Monticello. If you did nothing else but try to create wine, that could consume a very active life. And I was busy with other things and frequently gone, and my overseers had much less interest in this than I had. And so even though I grew grapes and had intended to press grapes for wine, I never was able to do so in the course of my lifetime.
You did grow a number of varieties, though, with success.
Oh, yes, I did. I'm an experimenter. I'm essentially an agricultural extension agent. And in some regards, Monticello was an agricultural extension laboratory or farm. I grew for my consumption, of course, tobacco. We grew for sale, but we grew wheat and rye and potatoes and so on for our consumption. And we had extensive gardens because we were, in a sense, our own grocery store. Everyone had to produce their own food. We had livestock, pigs, chickens, beef, sheep. You know, this was a production farm, but we, unlike the production farms in your era, we were subsisting on the fruits of our agricultural base. So all of that had to happen all the time. I, of course, supervised that. I didn't do much of that myself, except the flower and vegetable gardens, where I took great joy. But then I planted different types of orchards and grafted trees and experimented in what you would call genetic engineering. We weren't as aware of the delicacy of that as you have become. And I grew these vine stocks, and I had brought them from France. I had carefully labeled them. I'm a very meticulous man in that regard. And I wanted to see what grew in what soils, south-facing, north-facing, etc. But as I say, I wasn't able to see it through to wine. But I was able to do two things. I was able to distribute some of that vine stock to others, and they had more success. And secondly, and much more interestingly, in the 20th century, long after my death, the American wine industry was nearly destroyed by phylloxera, which is a root louse. And the French wine industry before that was nearly destroyed by phylloxera. And when the French wine industry was being decimated by this root louse, my vine stocks that I had brought from France and had flourished here were used to send back to France in the 20th century to repair their vines. And the French, although they're not very generous in these respects, the French will grudgingly acknowledge that their transported vine stocks, which I brought back in 1789 and which proliferated in this country, were re-imported into France in the 20th century and saved the French wine industry.
As I mentioned earlier, we've gotten a number of emails from people, and I thank them all for sending them in, about an article in a magazine called The New Yorker, written by a Patrick Keefe, The article is titled The Jefferson Bottles. Let me just read a short portion from it. It says, "The most expensive bottle of wine ever sold at auction was offered at Christie's in London on December 5, 1985. The bottle was hand-blown, dark green glass, and capped with a nubby seal of thick black wax. It had no label. It had no label, but etched into the glass in a spindly hand was the year 1787, the word Lafitte, and the letters THJ.
Well, of course, it's historically interesting to think that a bottle of wine that I may have purchased or that I may actually have held in my hands could still exist 200 years later, 200 plus years later. And I suppose antiquarians who, you know, collect handwriting from the 18th century or collect furniture or tapestries or draperies or whatever it is, you know, people that collect antiquities might find this interesting, but you know, I find it a little silly, frankly. It was wine. It's not the Charter of the University of Virginia. It's not the Bill of Rights. It's a bottle of wine.
Well, sir, in closing, I will tell you that the testing says that it is very drinkable. It's been preserved and is in very good condition, and it is a fine Bordeaux. Perhaps you would like to ask for it back.
No, but if I had the money, the 150 or so thousand, it could have saved Monticello. As you know, I died deeply in debt, $104,000 in debt in 1826 currency. That's millions and millions of dollars in your time, and I would have gladly had any recovery of the immense investment there. The bottle of wine would have been a very small value in my time. Its enormous value in your time could certainly be used as a gift to Monticello for the restoration of the gardens and the orchards and for Poplar Forest, too. And I think that would be a proper use of at least some portion of the proceeds of a sale of that sort.
Mr. President, I thank you for this fine conversation. I've enjoyed listening to you so much this week. And perhaps if it's within your schedule, you could share a glass of wine with me some afternoon.
Well, I have a bottle of Chateau Yquem here. And now that we have finished our conversation and the need to be alert begins to diminish, perhaps we could open it and decant it. And in half an hour or so, I'll let you taste the finest wine in the world.
I treasure that invitation, sir, and I accept.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Thomas Jefferson Hour. Welcome back to the Thomas Jefferson Hour, your weekly conversation with President Thomas Jefferson. Mr. Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author Clay Jenkinson. I'm your host, David Swenson, and seated across from me now is another wine connoisseur, Mr. Clay Jenkinson. It was a fun conversation this week.
I wish it were true, David. I would love to be a wine connoisseur. I actually think there are two types of wine connoisseurs, a very tiny handful of people who really know something about wine, and then a very large group of wine snobs who wish they were connoisseurs and lord it over everybody else about it.
Well, you may have a point. You know, it seems that there is a cottage industry of falsifying old wines, and the chances that the counterfeiters are going to get caught is pretty slim, because most of the people who buy it can't tell the difference, and a lot of people just buy it to put on their shelves.
Well, A, they can't tell the difference, and B, the will to believe is just gigantic, and
that's
people
true.
Frequently get engaged in fraudulent transfers of sports memorabilia, of manuscripts and autographs and so on. And there's a famous instance that I won't digress on of the Mormon forger, a man named Mark Hoffman, who actually fooled the world for many years by forging pseudo-Mormon documents, first ones that were pro-LDS and later ones that were antagonistic towards the LDS tradition. And the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints paid hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to buy these manuscripts in order to suppress them. And Mark Hoffman is regarded by many as the greatest forger ever in the history of the forgery of handwriting. There's also forgery of wines and other memorabilia and so on. It's a big deal. Greek vases, statues from the ancient world, the famous forgeries in paleontology and archaeology and so on and so forth. The donation of Constantine, which is regarded as one of the foundations of modern Christendom from the early modern world, turned out to be a forgery and was detected in the Renaissance. Forgery is a big deal, and the reason why forgery works is partly because of the mastery of the forgers, but it chiefly works because of the gullibility of those who buy things that have been forged. The will to believe in the human character is just gigantic. And so someone says, oh, I could have a bottle of wine that was owned by President Thomas Jefferson, and that somehow is so important that they suspend their critical skills and don't see things properly authenticated. They're afraid of authentication because, of course, it frequently proves to be a fake. And so the world is filled with this sort of thing, and it clouds the historical record in a really serious way. I'm not doubting that this is an authentic bottle of Jefferson's wine. I'm absolutely incapable of knowing that. But if it's drinkable, it's probably not authentic, because wines that have been around for a couple of hundred years almost invariably become vinegar. And of course, no one buys them to drink them. That would be insane. You buy it to have that bottle of wine on your shelf, and then everyone who comes into your house for the rest of time, you say, oh yeah, this is a bottle of Mr. Jefferson's wine. I bought a bottle that Mr. Jefferson owned. And there's this pretentiousness to it. And I believe in collecting. You know, I have one or two good books in my immense library, and I love book collectors. I love collectors of all sorts, but I don't particularly like wine snobs. And
but wine, you do enjoy a good glass of wine.
I love wine, of course, and I've learned a lot about wine, because I'll tell you how it happened, David. A number of years ago, this is one of the greatest honors of my life. I have such a fortunate life in many respects. I get to meet presidents, and I get to meet Supreme Court justices, and I've spoken before 20-some state legislatures, and I get these amazing experiences that are just, they make me almost pinch myself that just by dressing up as a dead man, these things have come to me in the course of my life. And a number of years ago, I had the chance to meet and work with Robert Mondavi of Mondavi Wines in Napa Valley. Robert Mondavi is essentially the patriarch of the California wine industry. He's one of the most extraordinary men that I've ever met. He's a beautiful man, an elegant man, a passionate man, a man deeply committed to excellence. And he was interested in Jefferson and wine, and so he invited me to come to Napa Valley to speak as Jefferson about wine, and as myself about Jefferson and wine. And I've known him now for 15 or more years, and his lovely wife, Marguerite, and their assistant, Nina Weems, who's one of the most elegant persons that I've ever met in my life. And it was just such a marvelous experience to be able to watch him. And I'll never forget one experience. They have these tastings. And I was sort of a fly on the wall at this tasting. And when they do tastings that involve the masters, you know, when they do the public, you get typical wine glasses. But when Robert Mondavi comes for a tasting or his wine masters, all the glasses are smoked glasses. So you can't see the wine because it's about taste. And they don't want to prejudice the the response by letting them see the wine. They just want it to be about taste alone. And so they lined up 10 wine glasses on this table, this beautiful table. You can just imagine. It's like a scene out of, you know, House Beautiful. 10 glasses, smoked glasses, and they poured 10 different wines, I think it might have been Cabernets, into these glasses from all over. And Robert Mondavi had not been in the room when the wines were poured, and he walked in and he tasted each one in turn. Tasted a glass, spit it out into a spit cup, tasted another glass. He went down the line. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, tasted them all. And then he said, this one is from X Vineyard. This one is from Y Vineyard. This one is from Z Vineyard. This one is ours, and I want to know why it's not the best. And he knew where each one was from. He could discriminate them, and he knew the best, and it wasn't his. And he wasn't angry, but he wanted to know why his wasn't the best. And it was so, it was like seeing magic when magic actually works. This man has one of the great palates. That's why he produced some of the greatest wines in the New World. And as you know, our best wines now have competed successfully in blind tastings with the best Bordeaux's. It was just glorious to sit in a room with one of the supreme masters of something. You know, it wouldn't have mattered if it were a poet or a sculptor or a painter or a musician, but to be in the room with one of the world's greatest masters and to see the magic of him at work was one of the greatest experiences of my whole life. And so I learned a fair amount about wine. I, for example, know that there's red and white. and it was just great. And I've done a lot of talking about wine with and for Robert Mondavi since. And now I am an honorary member of the Napa Valley Reserve, which is a wine cooperative in Napa Valley, and people from around the world and the country who are interested in wine are serious about it. Instead of buying a vineyard, which costs a fortune, you know, $25 or $30 million, these people can buy into a winery, the Napa Valley Reserve, and then they go out and they mix their own wine and they create their own label. And this is not for sale, but then they have, you know, 30 cases of the David Swenson label or the Clay Jenkinson label, and then they can serve these at their dinner parties and give them away as Christmas gifts and so on. It's a marvelous idea, and I'm an honorary member of the Napa Valley Reserve. I've not produced any wine.
Jefferson would approve.
He would approve because this allows – it's a democratization of wine. It means that somebody much wealthier than I am, believe me, much, much, much wealthier, but not infinitely wealthy, can say to his friends, oh, I have a little vineyard in California, Napa Valley, and my wife and children and I go out there and we mix our wine, and we'd like to serve you this year's Cabernet, and so on. And so it's a marvelous idea, and it just gives me great joy to be there because everything that Robert Mondavi does, he does as well as it can be done. And in fact, I'll just tell you one more story. I had the chance to, he belongs to something called the Bohemian Club, which is a very interesting group of men, all males, who go to the Redwoods in Northern California every summer for retreat. It's been much caricatured, and it's been the source of great controversy over the years, but it's also one of the world's greatest organizations. I mean, you're walking down through these magnificent 300-foot Redwoods, and you stop, and there's Henry Kissinger, and then you walk another quarter of a mile, and there's Jimmy Carter, and then there's David Gergen, and it's unbelievable. And you see the finest musicians, the finest filmmakers, the finest this and that in the world, diplomats, political figures, and they're all out there, you know, dressed in their Bermuda shorts and wandering amongst Redwoods. And I went to one of the camps where Robert Mondavi is a member. And he has each summer he has a meal that he sponsors at this camp. The camps are all made entirely out of redwood. And there were, you know, I suppose 50 wealthy, elegant, cultured men at this event. And they poured reserve wines from Mondavi. And, you know, Mondavi's wines are always good, but his reserve wines are just, you know, you're in the presence of great wine when you drink those. And I'm just sitting there, you know, just thrilled to be there. And they had three men who stood up and played violins. and one of them was a Stradivarius. And they were just leaving them around on these benches because it's this sort of atmosphere. And to hear extraordinary music on the violin played by masters on a Stradivarius in the Redwoods with Robert Mondavi presiding and his best reserve wines being drunk just the way Jefferson had in mind. No one drinking to excess, everyone drinking and realizing that this is a supreme aesthetic pleasure. Now, I hasten to say, there's an elitism there. We're talking about wealth. We're talking about privilege. That's not quite Jefferson's view of this country. He's a small D Democrat. And I can't afford to be part of that world, really. Now, I can't afford it financially, but worse, I'm not cultured enough, finally, for that world. That bothers me somewhat. But it's nevertheless fun from time to time to go be on the periphery of that world and look in on it and say, wow, you know, if I were wealthy, I would have fine wines. I wouldn't be serving Van Ordinaire. But you also have to develop the taste. And I know I'm rambling on about this, but one of my closest friends is a man named Thomas Pinney, formerly a professor of English at Pomona College in Claremont, California. He's written two volumes on the history of wine in America, and they are considered the definitive works. So if you're interested, Tom, we'll post this on our website, jeffersonhour.org. Thomas Pinney has two just magnificent books on the history of wine in the United States, and he knows about as much about this as any person can ever know. And he said to me one day, never buy more than a $10 bottle of wine. He said, wine snobs buy labels and they buy for all the wrong reasons. He said, buy the best $10 bottle of wine you can get and go to Wine Spectator or other wine magazines to determine what those wines are. But he said, a person who buys a $30, a $50, a $70 bottle of wine is almost inevitably throwing $50, $60 away unless he or she really knows what they're doing. Some do. But for you and me, when you go into a wine store and you think, oh, it's a special occasion, I'll buy a $30 bottle of wine or a $50 bottle of wine, you're essentially just being pretentious. And he said, buy the best $10. He said, there are enormous numbers of fine $10 a bottle wines in the world, and if you don't buy those, you're just being silly. And that was a great affirmation of a more democratic spirit about wine.
There's the $10 bottle of wine, and then we're back to the $157,000 bottle of wine, which I don't really want to give an opinion of on this story either, but it was pretty interesting. And they get into carbon dating, and it's a fun read.
It's a fun read, I hope, and I think people can find it online.
Yes, they can.
The New Yorker article.
The New Yorker.
Who was the author again?
Patrick Keefe.
And it was recent. It was a
September
month or so.
3rd.
Right. So people can take a look at that. And this happens from time to time. Every 3 or 4 years, a bottle of that, of Jefferson's or purportedly Jefferson's wine services. And I remember the last time, or one of the last times, David, somebody dropped one and broke it.
Oh, my.
After spending $150,000 on it.
Oh, my.
And that had to be a very bad day. And I'd be thrilled to have a $150,000 bottle of wine on my mantle.
Well, a lot of the article deals with whether or not it's a battle between people, whether it's authentic or
not.
Fake.
Oh,
but the line that I really enjoyed was one of the fellows who ended up with a bottle of the Jefferson wine was, it didn't really matter if it was authentic or not, because he could brag that he had the Jefferson wine or he could brag that he had the fake Jefferson wine. And in his mind, it was a pretty equal balance.
At a certain point, it becomes the same thing. But I'll tell you what, if I had $150,000, I wouldn't spend it on that bottle of wine. I would
pay off the mortgage, right? Just like
pay
Jefferson.
Pay down my Visa bill.
Right, yeah.
But I mean, or do something philanthropic or something. But, you know, there is I get that we have rich and we have super rich, but there is a very severe problem of class that has emerged in this country. It's always been here, but now it has become endemic. And there is an elitism and a kind of a swagger to the super rich and to what they can buy. And it's really fundamentally wrong. Jefferson was fundamentally a radical on this question. He lived better than most people, but he, in a sense, is a proto-Marxist of a certain type. And the emerging class reification, in which class has become almost a permanent feature of certain families in American life, would appall Jefferson. And I want to be one of the elegant ones. I want to travel with Robert Mondavi. I want to hear a Stradivarius. I want to drink fine wines. I want to go to the best places and so on and so forth. But you know what? I'm a North Dakotan, and some part of me that catches in my throat, and I feel even when I'm bumped up in an airplane to first class, not because I paid for it, but because I fly so much that sometimes they bump me up, I feel a little out of place. I feel like it must show that there must be a letter on my sleeve that says steerage, you know, really belongs in steerage. And I have to say, I'm kind of bugged about it. I'm a little offended by the false privileged elitism that has emerged and is now so socially acceptable in our time.
That is a conversation I would like to have with Mr. Jefferson, but it's going to have to wait because next week we're going on location. We're going to record you speaking at Bismarck State College on Constitution Day.
You better hope I show up for that.
I'm certain you will. But now, sir, we are about out of time, so I just want to take the few seconds we have left and thank the many listeners who are visiting the website, www.jeffersonhour.org, and sending questions in for you and for the president, and listening to the show there. And remind them that we read every piece of mail. We're getting bombarded and we're not keeping up, but we're doing our best.
Just two things. Read Thomas Pinney's two books on the history of wine in America. We'll post those on our site. And I understand there is a new study of Robert Mondavi and the House of Mondavi. I don't know the author, but we'll post that book on our site too. Meeting Robert Mondavi was one of the great experiences of my life. And he's one of the world's supreme artistic masters. And it's worth drinking his wines, and it's worth reading about the House of Mondavi.
And with that, sir, I say goodbye.
I'll see you next week.
The Thomas Jefferson Hour is distributed nationally by Prairie Public Broadcasting and brought to you by the New Enlightenment Radio Network, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the search for truth in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson. President Jefferson lived from 1743 to 1826, and this program presents his views. President Jefferson is portrayed by the award-winning humanities scholar and author, Clay Jenkinson. If you would like to obtain a copy of this or any past show for a $12 donation, please call 1-888-828-2853. Again, that number, 1-888-828-2853. The program is also available online at www.jeffersonhour.org and on iTunes. If you would like to correspond with President Jefferson or submit a question for him to answer on the show, visit the website. Again, that's www.jeffersonhour.org. The Thomas Jefferson Hour is produced at Mokoche Recording Studios in Bismarck, North Dakota. Music by Stephen Swinford. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week for another thought-provoking, historically accurate program through the eyes of Thomas Jefferson.